The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics, your daily guide to the corridors of power. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Today, no election before Christmas in Northern Ireland as the political deadlock over post-Brexit trade rules continues. We'll speak to the deputy leader of the Alliance Party, Stephen Farry.
Plus, we'll hear from former Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, about what he makes of the latest austerity drive by the government. But first, a nice story on the Bloomberg terminal, Stephen. The Chancellor's been joking about the challenging economic situation that he's facing. Speaking to a gathering of senior business leaders, Jeremy Hunt is reported to have likened his job to the interesting stuff, shall we say, he used a stronger word than that, that faced Barack Obama during the 2008 financial crisis. Now, Stephen, another man who's deep with the challenging economy, that is the Bank of England governor.
No jokes at all from Andrew Bailey. I think yesterday it was a pretty gloomy outlook we got from the BOE. Britain, he says, is headed for a deep recession. That's after they announced the biggest interest rate rise in 33 years. Interest rates going up to a 14-year high. Unemployment rising to just above 5%, even if borrowing costs remain steady. You're talking about 500,000 job losses, 18 months of recession, 1.7% off GDP. It's none of it really. There's kind of very little light in that tunnel, if you listen to Andrew Bailey.
No, a huge amount of gloom. But he did strike one interesting dovish note, which the markets will not have let get past them, and that was on interest rates. And he said that he warned that markets were pricing in too many rate hikes for the US. Fascinating contrast with yesterday's decision by the Federal Reserve. The Fed Chair Jay Powell said that US rates will probably go higher than people are thinking. So a real divergence between the UK and the US on the future rate path. Ahead of the decision yesterday, markets were expecting UK rates to peak at 4.75%. So Andrew Bailey saying that perhaps they won't go quite as high as that. A sign that there is some sort of moving apart of the two economies, because the UK economy in a much weaker position than the US. Growth is stronger in the US, and the UK economy has the massive energy problem, which is fueling our inflation. The US also has inflation, but it is not fueled by the energy crisis which we have in Europe. So that is a particular problem which the UK economy faces along with Europe.
If you were to be flippant about it, it's sort of like we've got two central bankers playing higher or lower. Who's going to move their rates first? Who's going to be expected about that? But of course, we're never so flippant about the economy here on Bloomberg. We have been talking about the outlook for the UK with Diane Coyle. She's a former Treasury economist and Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. We asked her what the government could do now to improve things.
It obviously is a bit depressing. It's important to note that the Bank of England forecast is using the interest rates that the markets are pricing in. And it was signalling at the same time that it doesn't expect that the rates will go quite so high. So it might not be all that bad. But for many people, it already is. Mortgage rates have already gone up. There's research from the National Institute showing that thousands of households now have mortgage payments due that are more than their monthly take-home pay. And there's the energy shock and food prices going up. So for some people, we're already in a really bad position, and that's going to continue for some time. What the bank's trying to do, I think, is manage expectations to embed the idea that it's going to not let inflation stay high, it will bring it down. But at the same time, provide a little bit of reassurance from its messaging around the forecast that perhaps it won't be quite as bad as it's saying.
It seems evident that there is still an issue with the Conservative government in terms of the criticism of institutions. Do you think that that has damaged the UK now. The criticism, again, from the Trade Secretary, Kemi Badenoch, who was speaking to us here on Bloomberg Radio. She basically disputed the OBR's views around kind of forecasting, was quite critical of them, criticised the fact that they thought that Brexit would harm trade in the long term. She didn't agree. And you've had that kind of repeated criticism from the Conservatives, of the OBR, of the Bank of England. Do you think that that has damaged those institutions?
It's really unhelpful of politicians to undermine those kinds of institutions at precisely the moment when we have had, when we've seen the damage that can do to people's monthly income and their standard of living. It's incredibly damaging to do that. I mean, it's not that these institutions should be above criticism, and there are many things that you could criticise them for. And I myself have in the past criticised the Treasury for some of its very embedded attitudes. So it's not wrong, but it's the way that you do it and the way that reality gets disputed. I mean, there is no denying the impact that Brexit has had on trade and on investment since the vote in 2016 and since the implementation of all the measures.
But there is denial. There's sort of widespread denial across the whole of the UK, but particularly in the political class, that is true.
Well, there's denial in the sense that you can deny reality. I'm talking about the reality of it. And the many, many companies that are trying to export and struggling now and will continue to struggle. And the fact that importing components and medicines is becoming so much more difficult. I mean,
Do you think that Rishi Sunak, with all of his city experience, is in denial about the impacts of Brexit?
Well, I think he's restricted in what he can say about it.
How does Britain move on from that? I mean, aside from the denial issues, there are practical elements that could be addressed. What could ease that damage that you're talking about?
Well, I think it would be quite straightforward to have discussions with the European Union that eased some of the restrictions withdrew from some of the more damaging, long-term damaging elements. For example, there's no reason to leave the Erasmus programme or to leave the European University Institute. Universities are one of our major export sectors. Why damage those unnecessarily? So there's plenty of scope for any politician, any government, to have discussions with the European Union to sort out some of the practical issues. So I'm an economist, not a political expert, but it seems to me this is all about internal management of the Conservative Party. And the Prime Minister and Chancellor will have to decide how to deal with that.
Just briefly, we're coming towards the end of our conversation, Diane. Do you think that the Labour Party under Keir Starmer has got any better solutions to, you know, the deep crisis really that Britain is in and could be in for the next kind of 2 years at least?
There are no quick solutions to the crisis. I think the challenge for any government, Labour or Conservative, is to set out a long-term strategy for the economy, which requires substantial investment by public and private sectors, and stick to it and not keep changing fundamentally important structural policies all the time. And to do so in a way that empowers other regions of the country outside London and the South East to get on with things.
That was Cambridge Professor Diane Coyle speaking to Carolyn Hepburn and I a little bit earlier.
Now, one person who might be a little bit hurt at hearing Diane call it 12 years of Conservative government is our next guest.
Yeah, former Chief Secretary to the Treasury and Liberal Democrat Danny Alexander set up the Office for Budget Responsibility and implemented cuts to government spending alongside George Osborne in the 2010 government. He's now Vice President of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and he gave us his assessment of the situation facing the UK economy today.
You know, back in 2010, we had the consequences of the global financial crisis. There was a real need to get the UK's public finances back in order to underpin growth and development of the UK in future. And actually, when the coalition government finished in 2015, you know, the economic forecasts were looking quite positive. It is obviously challenging now. It's a challenging situation.
Challenging is an understatement.
Yeah, probably it is. Even more challenging.
I mean, 18 months of recession, massive cost of living crisis, mortgage rates have gone up to 6%. These are enormous.
These are enormous challenges. And Jeremy Hunt and his colleagues have an extremely big job to do. I don't live in the UK anymore. I'm not in a position to comment on all of the details. But clearly, after 2010, we made some extremely difficult decisions to get the country back on the right track. And it's I suspect, even more difficult now to do it again. And I'm sure that is going to be something that, you know, I think the issue that we face, and I'm sure it's the same now, is how do you get the balance right between taking the steps you need to take to stabilize the economy, while at the same time doing so in a way that is fair and doesn't hit the poorest in the country hardest. That must be the right motivation. So I'm sure people will look at it through that lens. Mm. And how do you also help people through these very challenging short term situations, like with energy prices? I don't know what the right answer is. And I'm not
but
here in the UK.
You must have a hunch about whether it's right to cut public spending in the way that is expected. I mean, the forecast is a hole of between, well, depending on the analysis, between £30 and £60 billion in terms of public finances. Bloomberg Economics thinks 35, maybe 50% from tax rises, 50% from slashing public spending. Do you have a view on? You know, whether there is more to cut in terms of public spending?
It's a long time since I was involved directly with that, so I'm not really going to give any kind of detailed commentary. But I do know that to do that is even more challenging based on what's happened over the last few years. And I'm sure that's why Jeremy Hunt will take, you know, great care to handle this properly. As to what the outcome will be, I can't comment on that.
Okay. In terms of growth, I mean, everybody seems to now have coalesced around this view that growth has been so slow in the UK and that is the one key that needs to change. Is there something that Britain needs to do to, you know, what is, I guess, the one thing that Britain should do to boost growth?
Well, back in the period when I was in the government, we had a big focus on infrastructure investment as part of the long-term growth story. But that's what I'm doing now in Asia for developing countries, and I continue to believe that well targeted, well thought through, high quality infrastructure projects have a significant role to play in long term sustainable growth. And you know, in that period when I was responsible, you know, we sought to maintain the spending on the most growth enhancing infrastructure, for example, around transport, even though in other areas we had to reduce spending. Now, that will be harder, but...
Yeah, areas that are being considered for cuts now.
But from a growth point of view, infrastructure investment is clearly very important.
I mentioned that you, your history in government and politics in the UK, you also had a hand in setting up the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, which is the independent watchdog that kind of marks the government's homework. We were speaking to the Trade Secretary this week, Kerry Badenoch. She was another government minister that bashed the OBR in terms of talking about having a different view to the OBR, even though it's the independent government watchdog. This is really weakening the system in Britain, surely, to have ministers repeatedly undermining. I suppose, what do you make of it, having had a hand in the creation of the OBR?
Well, I haven't followed these debates recently, but I can say that the reason we set up the OBR was precisely to have an independent view of the economic forecasts. You know, I think in the past you'd often seen governments sometimes tweaking the economic forecast to make their job a wee bit easier. I think having an independent view, which is transparent, helps a lot with the quality of decision making and the transparency around the economic processes in this country. Now, it's then a matter for the government. How does it decide to react to that? That's exactly
but
as
you
it,
have
as it
faith
should be.
In the OBR as it is set up, as it functions.
I think that the institution of the OBR is a really important innovation in the quality of UK economic decision making. I haven't followed its work in the last few years, so I can't comment on that. But as an institution, it was set up to play an important role, and it's one that I think has strengthened economic governance in the UK.
That was Danny Alexander, former Chief Secretary to the UK Treasury, now at the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Well, up next, there is going to be no pre-Christmas election in Northern Ireland. I'm sure the voters will not be upset about that. That's the words of Northern Ireland's Secretary.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Now, the Northern Ireland Secretary, Chris Heaton-Harris, says he won't be calling an election now as an Assembly election before Christmas. There is a legal obligation to hold that vote for Stormont by the 20th of January by the latest. It had been expected to happen on December the 15th, but now Heaton-Harris says he'll be addressing Parliament on this matter next week. Now, Stephen, you've been across all of this. How do we get here?
Well, Northern Ireland hasn't had a functioning government since February of this year. Back then, it was the Democratic Unionist Party's Paul Given, who was First Minister, who resigned in protest at the post-Brexit trading rules known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. So we had elections for the Stormont Assembly in May. They were noteworthy for a few reasons. For the first time, Sinn Féin, representing the nationalist community, emerged as the largest party, which would have put them in line to take the First Minister role for the first time. It did see a fall in support for the DUP. They lost 3 seats and saw the Cross Community Alliance Party make big gains to become the third largest party in the Northern Ireland Assembly. Since then, the DUP has refused to join an executive, and under the power-sharing rules in Northern Ireland, that means that both the nationalist and the unionist community need to be represented in government. The DUP is the biggest unionist party, so without them, no executive.
But this kind of political deadlock isn't new in Northern Ireland, though, is it?
No, and it's actually built into the system that was created under the 1998 peace deal. Collapsing the executive has happened many times since then. On previous occasions, it's meant that Northern Ireland ends up being ruled directly from Westminster. The longest hiatus was 3 years. That ended in January 2020 when the British and Irish governments, along with the parties in Northern Ireland, signed up to an agreement called New Decade, New Approach. That created a new set of rules which said that if there wasn't an executive for 6 months, then the Northern Ireland Secretary must, by law, call an election within 12 weeks. So that 6 month period expired on the 28th of October. The clock is now running on those 12 weeks. Before the deadline expired, Chris Heaton-Harris said that he would call an election if the parties couldn't reach a deal. They had been preparing for one, as you say, in December, but the announcement still hasn't happened. And today we have Chris Heaton-Harris saying it won't happen before Christmas. That election legally has to happen by the 20th of January at the latest. So we're waiting to see what the Northern Ireland Secretary says about this next week.
Why does the DUP not want to join government?
This is all to do with the Northern Ireland Protocol. This is the deal the UK government agreed with the EU for Brexit. It keeps Northern Ireland in the EU single market for goods, prevents a border on the island of Ireland, but it does mean that goods travelling from Great Britain to Northern Ireland need to be checked for things like food standards when they enter Northern Ireland. The DUP doesn't like that. They say it creates a border in the Irish Sea and undermines Northern Ireland's place as part of the UK. That is a view that's shared by other unionist parties, but others are actually willing to go into government while London negotiates these issues with Brussels. More broadly, there is a majority of people in polling that support the Northern Ireland Protocol, see it as a good thing for Northern Ireland. So 54% see it as good, 39% see it as bad. Business groups like Manufacturing NI have told us they see it as an opportunity for business in the region. But because of the nature of power sharing, it's not a majority rule system. You have to have both communities on board. And that's why until now we haven't seen an executive being formed.
Well, let's bring in Stephen Farry. He's deputy leader of the Alliance Party, also MP for North Down. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg UK Politics. Let's start off with your reaction to this decision by Chris Heaton-Harris to delay the election.
Well, I think it is the right decision. There wasn't really any appetite in Northern Ireland for an election, particularly at this time, with Christmas coming up and also in the midst of the cost of living crisis. But also we know from our history, having an election in the context of a political vacuum doesn't really change anything. We'll come back with the same issues, but it may be even more difficult, especially if parties go to the electorate and entrench their red lines. Makes the mountain we have to climb even steeper.
Well, is there any hope of the issue actually being resolved before that deadline that's in January?
Well, we're not sure if January will be the deadline or if that's now going to shift. I mean, having an election outside of Christmas is going to be complicated enough in terms of the logistics. We're very much in the hands here of what the speed of the UK-EU negotiations around trying to find some modifications to the protocol. I mean, indeed, most people in Northern Ireland do support the protocol or recognise that it is necessary, but there is some fine-tuning that does need to take place. So in a sense, I mean, this particular crisis is slightly different from ones that have gone before, in that the main issue of contention lies outside the scope of the internal politics of Northern Ireland. It's an international negotiation. But most of us are of the opinion that we should be doing devolution at the same time as these discussions are taking place, rather than one party making a particular outcome in the protocol a precondition. But then this begs the question, if we do see a deal over the next few weeks or months, is that actually going to be something that's satisfactory to the DUP? They've made their position so extreme in some respects that a pragmatic outcome may not be something they feel that they can support. And it's for that reason we are stressing the need to do some reforms to the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement. The principles, the broad structures, the cross-cutting relationships remain as valid as ever. But 25 years on, it's clear that some of the structures don't work, and in particular this issue of the veto, where either of the two largest parties can actually prevent the government from being formed, isn't really tenable. It wasn't tenable back whenever Sinn Féin brought down the institutions in 2017, and it isn't tenable now.
But to renegotiate that, though, requires both the British and Irish governments being on board with that. Are Anglo-Irish relations at a stage where that could happen? Because it's a pretty major change.
Certainly, Anglo-Irish relations have been badly dented over the past few years by Brexit, but we have seen a thawing over the past few weeks, which is very welcome. And in particular, we have seen some recognition from, in particular, the Irish Taoiseach, that reform may be necessary. Now, for us, we are impatient to see that reform taking place, because if we see a prolonged standoff, then the other default is that we end up in some form of direct route from London, albeit with an Irish dimension, which will be a very sensitive aspect to get right, and will clearly sort of upset some people, and others won't think it goes far enough. So before you can get to that point, we're saying that let the parties in Northern Ireland who want to run Northern Ireland have a go at doing so, but we need reform to allow that to happen.
Now, your party leader met with the Northern Ireland secretary. He met with all the party leaders in Northern Ireland. Are you hopeful about the situation? There does seem to be some kind of thawing of relations between the UK and the Irish and Brussels. Do you think things are moving in the right direction?
Well, I think to be realistic, we have to recognise we're in a very deep rut here. I mean, Brexit in particular has posed real challenges to Northern Ireland politics. We always knew that Northern Ireland was a place that only could work through sharing and interdependence, and Brexit really creates a whole series of fault lines, both political and economic. In some ways, the protocol is the best way of trying to provide a soft landing, but it's far from perfect in that respect. We have seen a lot of instability over the past 6 or 7 years, and indeed over the past 25 years, the institutions have only been functional for 60% of the time, so 40% non-operational. So that points to deeper structural problems. And I think the depth of the dispute at present is probably bigger than we have seen in previous situations before. So it's not impossible, and reform may well be the key, but I think we have to recognise the scale of the challenge before us.
Do you get the impression that things have changed since Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister? Do you think that his government is serious about finding solutions to these problems with the EU?
Well, we've yet to see Rishi Sunak making any statement in relation to Northern Ireland and indeed the protocol. So to a certain extent, we are guessing. There is an assumption that has been made that he did intervene in relation to the calling of an election. He has been more pragmatic in the past around aspects of the protocol, but like all members of the Conservative government, they have supported the protocol bill, which isn't really helpful in terms of trying to get this over the line. So I'm hopeful that he will be much more pragmatic around this and recognise that he does need to have a deal with the European Union, but we don't yet have the concrete evidence in front of us yet just to make any definitive view on that.
What does not having a functioning executive mean for Northern Ireland? Presumably you're facing the same cost of living situation that we are in the rest of the UK. The NHS has its troubles as it does in the rest of the UK. Has it made things noticeably worse.
Absolutely. And in both those respects, Northern Ireland is probably worse off than the rest of the UK. We have longer waiting lists we have more people who are dependent on benefits than anywhere else in the UK. So the cost of living crisis really cuts very deep here. At present, we don't have an executive budget in place for this current financial year. I mean, we're almost coming towards the end of it. So departments are just basically spending in a vacuum. And some aspects of the cost of living support that are already being rolled out in Great Britain haven't yet been delivered in Northern Ireland. So there's a real crisis here. Now, we do expect that the NIO will put in place an emergency budget for Northern Ireland. That's just keeping the lights running. It's not going to be taking any major strategic decisions about how things can be done differently.
Do you want Chris Heaton-Harris to change the law that underpins the New Decade, New Approach agreement to extend that 12-week deadline? And how long should it be extended for?
Well, I think, yes, that probably does need to be changed in some shape or form and extended. It was put in place for good reasons, but obviously the politics in Northern Ireland are more broken and we need a different approach. So I wouldn't put a date on it at this stage, but I think we do need to see rapid progress in terms of the UK-EU negotiations and then the fresh application of pressure on the DUP to go back in at that particular point.
Stephen, thanks so much for giving us your perspective. Really interesting. Stephen Farry, Deputy Leader of the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we'll be waiting to see what Chris Heaton-Harris tells the Parliament here in Westminster when he speaks next week. Those are essentially the options open to him, is because there is that deadline is in law. So it's a question of if they're going to change the law and how long they change it for, and then what the continuing impact of that is. So definitely something that we'll be watching here on the programme next week as well.
Yeah, something else to look forward to. COP27 starts in Sharm el-Sheikh on Sunday. Rishi Sunak now says that he's going. A lot of controversy over that. Interesting to see how long he stays there and if the parties can make some agreements on climate change. Watch out also for leaks ahead of the budget. Budget the 17th of November, something else which has been put off. We're expecting the government will start to dribble out some of its policy positions ahead
Surely
of that
not.
Day.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.